Let's begin. Alan is handing out two handouts that I hope will be helpful in case we get more of a crowd here. If you are, you have a good friend or companion, you may want to take one between the two of you so that we have enough to go around. One is a list of resources, an extensive list of resources where you can get more information. The other page is handed to you because it has a map that I find helpful on one side, and on the other side some films and where to get them that are useful for more information. And some of you are arriving now. I'm really happy to see because you can come and sit close to me and then I'll feel better about it.
This is the map, Mark.
I know, I have them right here. This session is called Our Treasure, Is There Apartheid in Israel? And it's the fifth session this week. I did False Treasure, What's Wrong with Charity? And you will not find that on the audio archives because of a little technical snafu. The second session was called A Buried Treasure, Steve Biko's Role in the Fall of Apartheid in South Africa. Third session was Enduring Treasure, and it looked at some of Biko's ideas and their relevance for our role in the larger human community today. And then yesterday, Revolving Treasure looked at microfinance as an answer to global poverty, critiqued the widely popular Kiva, and promoted the much lesser known ecumenical leader in microfinance, Boyko Credit. This session has kind of a curious title, Our Treasure, Is There Apartheid in Israel Today? And I'll keep you in suspense until a little bit later in the session when I'll explain what I mean by calling it Our Treasure. But in many ways, it sums up where I've been all week long. So an important caveat. This gentleman, I don't know your name.
I'm sorry. Robert.
Robert reminded us in the Bible study this morning that Christians have a long history of anti-Semitism. And as is the case with a white talking about racism sometimes, I have learned that it is really helpful when we help one another avoid the bigotries that we don't want but that come so naturally. I was much aided last year by a word after a session on Israel-Palestine that I did, when a woman came up to me and told me how hard it was for her to hear something I had said in the session, because she is Jewish, and I had made some reference to the Jews in a way that was really hard for her, and I thanked her for calling me out on that. And I will thank anyone in the room today who can call me or one another out on anti-Semitic language. What I'm talking about is the policies of the State of Israel, and I will quote Israeli Jews and their views about that, as well as people, Palestinians, Palestinian Christians, and South Africans, and you'll get some of my opinions on the subject as well. This is not meant to be anti-Semitic, but it might because that's my heritage. So call me if you hear that. Or let's call one another if we hear anti-Semitic. It is possible to approach this subject with anti-Semitic intentions or motives. But it is also possible, I believe, to talk about the policies of the State of Israel in a manner that shows great concern and love for Jewish people as well as others living in the State of Israel. So that's just an opening reminder to ourselves that we are creatures still in formation, and we may need help to do that to grow in a better way. The historical background for this session is that I lived in South Africa for 2 years, 76 and 77, and then spent another 10 years advocating for an end to apartheid, and along the way met a Palestinian woman once, who sat me down one evening and proceeded to tell me the history of how things have unfolded in Israel over the last century, and drew parallels that I found striking to South Africa. And I've never been the same since. I've lost touch with her, but I remain grateful to her for that. A couple of years ago, when I got to St. Mark's Cathedral in Seattle, where I now work as a priest, a conference by, was a Sabeel conference, was organized in Boston and headlined by Desmond Tutu. And it was on the, the subject was the apartheid paradigm and whether or not it was accurate. The title was "The Apartheid Paradigm in Palestine, Israel, Issues of Justice and Equality." And since Tutu was going to be there, and since I expected him to argue that there is apartheid in Israel today, I thought it would be useful for me to go to the conference and get a quote from him to that effect, because fewer people are willing to argue with him than with me. And that it might be helpful to the cause of naming truth. What I found haunted me, and is what motivates me to wrap up a week of teaching this week by focusing on this subject. At that conference, Naeem Atik, who is an Anglican priest, Palestinian priest, lives in Jerusalem, and the head of Sabeel, which is an ecumenical liberation theology center in Jerusalem. Naeem Atik said at the conference, and I'll read to you from his speech. He quoted a member of the Israeli government to make his case that there is apartheid in Israel today. And he says, a recent example, one can cite an interview in Haaretz. Haaretz is the leading newspaper in Jerusalem, and on your list of resources, it's one of the, you have the website for Haaretz. There is a much more, there is much published in the major newspaper in Jerusalem today, Jewish newspaper in Jerusalem. Much that is published there, if quoted here, gets branded as anti-Semitic. So intolerant are we of discussion about this issue in this country. And Naeem Atik is quoting an interview in Haaretz with Haggai Alon, who was a senior advisor to Amir Peretz at the Ministry of Defense. Alon described his job as ensuring that the official statements made by the Israeli government regarding its policy toward the Palestinians were in fact implemented. The article quotes Alon saying, the IDF, Israeli Defense Force, the IDF is setting a route for the fence that will not enable the establishment of a Palestinian state and is allowing itself to evade high court orders to change the route, quote unquote. He claims that the Israeli army is, quote, carrying out an apartheid policy, which is emptying Hebron of Arabs, setting up roadblocks without anyone knowing where and how many, Judaizing the Jordan Valley, and cooperating openly and blatantly with the settlers. So, at the conference, for starters, the head organizer of the conference, Naeem Atik, actually, the conference was organized by Friends of Sabeel North America, which was not on that list of resources, so I wrote it in at the top. And if you're only going to go to one website following this this talk today, that would be the one I would suggest you go to. Sign up for their emails, and you will get a ton of information, including most of what I share with you today came through that email stream. Naeem Atik quotes a member of the Israeli government to make the case that there is apartheid in Israel today. One of the speakers at the conference was Farid Isaac, who was at that time a visiting professor at Harvard, black South African Islamic scholar. And Isaac had a brilliant presentation, which I don't have time to go into all the details of. Being a Muslim, it was kind of tricky for him to condemn what's happening in Israel. So he made an analogy to how men treat women. And he says that, how do we respond when a male insists that the only way I can conceive of my identity is in a relationship of superiority over women? Do we talk about and privilege this male identity in the way that this man is insisting on? Or do we say no? If men think that their maleness is irrevocably tied to the relationships of oppression with women, then that understanding of maleness must be destroyed. If that male gets hurt in the process, well, I'm sorry. I can't make your hurt the be-all and end-all of my life. You're in an oppressive relationship with a woman. A woman is being hurt. I understand that you may have been hurt before. I understand that you may be hurting others as a consequence of your own hurt. But at the moment, take your shoes off the neck of this woman. It was a very powerful analogy. Isaac says in his speech, if anything, and this is a black South African who fought against apartheid and was active in the struggle against apartheid in South Africa. He says, if anything, I think the apartheid analogy is often a weak analogy in relation to how the Palestinians are experiencing Zionism. In apartheid South Africa, we never had the walls that we see in Israel today. We never had separate roads for black people, 700 kilometers of segregated roads. We didn't have separate number plates for Arab cars. Our courts never sanctioned collective punishment. Our courts never sanctioned torture as the Israeli courts have. No, the apartheid regime never singled out for particular abuse the land, the destruction of olive groves and their fruits. Also at the conference was one of the most impressive people to me was Anat Beletsky, who is a philosopher of language, Israeli Jew, and a philosopher of language, and is now with the program on human rights and justice at MIT in the Boston area. And she provided some data on this issue of checkpoints. One of them, I'm going to make a case in a few minutes, that one of the fundamental tenets of apartheid is restricting the freedom of movement. She said there are 47 permanent checkpoints manned and womaned by Israeli soldiers. There are 33 checkpoints between the West Bank and Israel. The maps that you have show Israel. The West Bank is the dark area here. The Gaza Strip is here. I'm going to pass around the room these two postcards. If you have seen it before, just pass it on to your neighbor. We'll start one over here and one over here. Why don't you just go back and forth across the rows so that you can take a look at the graphic evidence of how land that was controlled by Palestinians has changed over time. And 1967 is just a crucial date for us to consider this afternoon, because that's when the land that had been considered Palestinian territories was occupied by the Israeli military in the war of 1967. And since that time, Israel has been an occupying power, illegal occupation of those territories since 1967, and a factor which will feature prominent in a few minutes. And movement within those territories is restricted by these checkpoints, 33 checkpoints between the West Bank and Israel, 73 gates in the wall, 200 flying checkpoints. You never know where they will be. Every day they put checkpoints in 200 different places. There are 217 dirt piles at entrances to the villages of Palestinians to prevent access or egress. 86 fences along the roadways, 93 locked gates at entrances to villages, 73 checkpoints in Hebron alone. These checkpoints, says this Israeli Jewish woman, are the icon of domination. We have to watch them. This is domination. She talks about the roads for Jews. I don't have time to go into the numbers here, but basically there are 700 kilometers that are segregated, that are not for Palestinians. There are different categorizations, completely prohibited, partially prohibited, physically restricted, etc. But its domination and equality are very clear there. John Dugard was there. John Dugard is a South African lawyer. Today he teaches, he's a professor of law, professor of human rights law at the University of Pretoria in South Africa, and is special rapporteur on the human rights situation in the occupied Palestinian territories to the UN Human Rights Council. And he had a great speech as a constitutional lawyer talking about apartheid in Israel. And Dugard, I'm not going to quote from his speech at that conference, because one of the things that he did was challenge the international community to examine whether or not international law is being violated in the case of Israel's occupation of the Palestinian territories. And just in May of this year, the Human Sciences Research Council, the National Social Science Council of South Africa, with 165 professional researchers, 63 technical and 128 support staff in 5 offices scattered around the country doing social science research on a large-scale policy-relevant projects for public agencies, public sector users, non-governmental organizations, and internal development agencies. A very sophisticated, government-funded social science research council in South Africa has just published this massive report. The executive summary is 15 pages of tiny print on the subject of occupation, colonialism, apartheid, ? And they state right up front that their intention is the nonpartisan perspective of international law rather than engaging in political discourse and rhetoric. So these are legal. They're looking at international law and trying to determine whether Dugard's request, whether or not Israel is clearly and is under international law guilty of violating, through its occupation of the Palestinian territories since 1967, is it violating international law on the subjects of colonialism and apartheid? And their findings, which I will just cite for you, on colonialism, are: by thus partitioning the contiguous blocks of Palestinian areas into cantons, reservations, Israel has violated the territorial integrity of the occupied Palestinian territories in violation of the Declaration on Colonialism. They start off by, what's the basis for international law about colonialism? Now, we don't hear much about it anymore. Some of you in the room look like you might be old enough to remember the movement in globally that called on colonial powers to give up their control of territory. There's probably enough Lutherans in the room to remember what the last colony in Africa was. Namibia. Say it louder.
Namibia,
that's right, a colony of South Africa. The whole notion of colonialism is not only illegal, but in the world that you and I live in, roundly condemned as unsustainable, and we don't even think of it as still going on. And this study by these social science researchers concludes strenuously that Israel is guilty under international law of practicing colonialism in how it administers the occupied territories, the occupied Palestinian territories. And the reasons are for control of economic sovereignty, for violating the right of permanent sovereignty over natural resources, particularly water, That is a dry part of the world. And the water resources, one of the reasons for the variegated nature of Palestinian control in the the green land on that map that's floating around here, the white area that Israel has been taking control over has the better water resources. And even where Palestinians are sitting on top of major water resources, the Israeli state is drilling in at an angle to draw water. Water is a highly politicized and colonized resource in the Palestinian territories. Israel is subordinated to the economy of the occupied Palestinian territories to its own through the creation of a customs union. The bypass road network and the wall have deprived Palestinian population of the control and development of an estimated 38% of the West Bank land. Water management and allocation that favors Israel and Jewish settlers in the occupied Palestinian territories to the detriment of the Palestinian population. Self-determination also has a cultural component. The self-determination is the opposite of colonialism. Colonialism is illegal under international law because it prevents people from determining their own future. You are allowed to occupy a territory by force temporarily, but not permanently. You're supposed to be there only long enough to help that the people in that territory determine their own future. The study demonstrates that the implementation of a colonial policy by Israel has not been piecemeal, but is systematic and comprehensive. And then it goes on to apartheid. Anat Beletsky, the philosopher of language, used most of her speech at that conference in Boston 2 years ago to argue that the problem in Israel is a racist problem. Now, that's a little bit awkward. I don't want to spend, we could spend the whole session on the question of race. I'm just going to tell you that race didn't exist until white people invented it as a concept in Europe about to justify the rise of colonialism. It biologically, there is no basis for it. I know that's a shocker, but it's true. You just cannot draw boundaries genetically between groups of people. It's all one big mess of humanity. But apartheid is based on notions of racial discrimination. Race is a social construct. It assumes a powerful reality in the United States, particularly, because of how we have constructed ideas about race and how we think about differentiating race. But biologically, it doesn't have a basis. Apartheid is defined by three international conventions. And those conventions, according to these people and their study, argue that determining race is one of them. And they conclude that while there's no scientific or impartial method exists for determining whether any group is a racial group, nevertheless, this study finds that Jewish and Palestinian identities are socially constructed as groups distinguished by ancestry or descent, as well as by nationality, ethnicity, and religion. And on this basis, our study concludes that Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs can be considered racial groups for the purposes of the definition of apartheid in international law. And then they go on to say, well, what are those definitions? How is apartheid, which according to international conventions has been declared illegal, and when it was defined and declared illegal, it was clearly stated that it was not just in South Africa. The purpose for the conventions internationally were to look at the situation in South Africa and ask, is this humane? Is this an acceptable policy? And the world community said no, and international law makes it illegal. And they define it in terms of characteristics. You don't have to have all six of these characteristics, but where they show up predominantly, you got apartheid, so the study argues. Those characteristics are include Israeli measures to repress Palestinian dissent. I'm just going with the conclusions here from the executive summary. And they document murder in the form of extrajudicial killings by the state of Israel now. Torture, which I already mentioned, has been sanctioned by the courts of Israel. Other cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment of detainees. A military court system that falls far short of international standards for fair trial. And arbitrary arrest and detention. So that's one of the categories, and they say it's present in Israel. The second category is the intent of causing the physical destruction of the Palestinian people, and they say no. There is not evidence that it is state policy to destroy the Palestinian people, you know, in the way Hitler tried to destroy Jewish people in Germany. Third, prevent a racial group from participation in the political, social, economic, and cultural life of the country, and they say this condition is satisfied on 10 separate accounts. Restricting the Palestinian rights to freedom of movement. I talked about the checkpoints. The right of Palestinians to choose their own residence within their territory is severely curtailed. Palestinians are denied the right to leave and return to their country. Israel denies Palestinians in the occupied Palestinian territories their right to a nationality. Palestinians are restricted in their right to work. Palestinian access to work inside Israel has been almost completely cut off. Palestinian trade unions exist but are not recognized by the Israeli government and cannot effectively represent Palestinians. Education is severely impeded by military rule. Freedom of opinion and expression is greatly restricted through censorship laws. I'm reading you one sentence out of a whole paragraph. That is the executive summary. Get the 160-page report and find the details. Palestinians' right to freedom of peaceful assembly and association is impeded through military orders. Most Palestinian political parties have been declared illegal. Effects of Israel's ongoing siege and regular large-scale military attacks on the Gaza Strip are a humanitarian crisis. That's the third category of whether or not measures calculated to prevent a racial group from participation in the political, social, and economic and cultural life of the country. And they say this condition of apartheid is met in Israel today, in Israel's occupation of the Palestinian territories. A fourth category, the division of population along racial lines, has three elements, two of which are satisfied. Israel divided the West Bank into reserves or cantons, in which residence and entry is determined by each individual group's identity. The one that is not satisfied is the prohibition on mixed marriages between Jews and Palestinians, but they talk about how if you get married, it's not against the law for Jews and Palestinian Arabs to marry one another, but if you choose to do that, there are major obstacles to living together. Private Palestinian land comprises about 30% of the land unlawfully appropriated for Jewish settlement in the West Bank, that West Bank territory after 1967. The Israeli state started with U.S. financial support, expropriating lots of the land in the West Bank now, and then building Jewish settlements. And those settlements are connected by a set of roads that only Jewish Israelis can drive on. So these segments within the West Bank are all that are reserved for Israeli Jews are all well connected to each other, but in between the Palestinian the Palestinian homes and farms are heavily segregated from one another, separated. So that separation, there's a lot in here. You have the link to the report yourself, and it's some of the best kind of academic research I've found on the subject. If you want all the political discourse removed and international law examined by researchers, then get a hold of this thing. I'm going to move on because all week long I have struggled with giving out too much data and missing the concluding points, and I'm determined not to let that happen
which
today.
Which link is this on that?
Yeah, can I borrow? On the back of the two pages, in my handwriting, is the Occupation, Colonialism, and Apartheid at the very end. See it? And it gives you a website where you can go to download the full report or the executive summary. Desmond Tutu was there, and as expected, let me read you what he published in an op-ed piece in the Boston Globe the day the conference opened. Boston Globe, the day before the conference opened, published an op-ed piece attacking the church which was hosting the conference. And then that set them up, you know, they have to be balanced. That set them up to publish this op-ed piece from Tutu on the day the conference opened. What do I see and hear in the Holy Land? I'm just quoting four paragraphs here. Some people cannot move freely from one place to another. A wall separates them from their families and from their incomes. They cannot tend to their gardens at home or to their lessons at school. They are arbitrarily demeaned at checkpoints and unnecessarily beleaguered by capricious applications of bureaucratic red tape. I grieve for the damage being done daily to people's souls and bodies. I have to tell the truth. Earlier in the op-ed piece, he talked about the tough, he says, I know from my experience in South Africa, I know that truth-telling is hard. It has grave consequences. And he says at the end of this paragraph, I have to tell the truth. I am reminded of the yoke of oppression that was once our burden in South Africa. I see and hear that ancient olive groves are uprooted, and they are ancient. They take generations and generations to cultivate. And some of those films that are on that sheet will show you the bulldozers uprooting them in front of the family who descends from the ancestors that cultivated them. Flocks are cut off from their pastures and shepherds. The homes of some people are bulldozed, even as some new homes for others are illegally constructed on other people's land. I grieve for the land that suffers such violence, the marring of its beauty and the loss of its comforts, the despoiling of its yield. I have to tell the truth. I'm reminded of the bitter days of uprooting and despoiling in my own country. I see and hear that young people believe that it is heroic and pious to kill others by killing themselves. There's a whole paragraph there, and he says, I have to tell the truth. I'm reminded of the explosive anger that inflamed South Africa too. Some people are enraged by comparisons between the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and what happened in South Africa. There are differences between the two situations, but a comparison need not be exact in every feature to yield clarity about what's going on. Moreover, for those of us who lived through the dehumanizing horrors of the apartheid era, the comparison seems not only apt, it is also necessary. It is necessary if we are to preserve our hope that things can change. We have to take note that South Africans, including those who we love to venerate as heroic, are devoting so much attention today, from the likes of Desmond Tutu, a Nobel Peace Prize winner, to a state-funded social sciences research council. They are devoting so much energy and attention to identifying the way in which apartheid is active in Israel today. And many say, and I would agree as one who lived under apartheid and have studied a bit of what's going on, that the situation is in some ways not alike, in many ways identical, and on balance, worse. And the worst news at all for me, as someone who proudly puts on the board at Holden Village at various times over the last 30 years, I started teaching about South Africa here 30 years ago this month, And at various times I have listed some of the things I'm proud of to have been associated with in the struggle against apartheid and in calling Americans to more information about the situation in South Africa. I have to tell you that the situation is worse in Israel, and Americans are far, far more responsible for it. And the only good news is that it would be a lot easier for us single-handedly as a nation to change the situation. What does Desmond Tutu say every single time he speaks in the United States, and three of his four children live here, so he comes often. What does he say every single time he speaks in the United States? He starts off with the same spiel. Who's heard it? Who knows what it is? At the very beginning of his speech, every single time, what does he say? Some of you have heard it. Take a guess. He thanks Americans for supporting economic sanctions against the government of South Africa. He does it in an emotionally moving, profoundly grateful tone. Our treasure, remember that's the title of this session, our treasure, is there apartheid in Israel today? Who knows some of the figures about our support economically? You know, those of us who pay taxes.
$8 billion a year.
$8 million a year?
$8 billion.
$8 billion a year, which, just to give it a number you maybe can relate to, is about $10 million a day. One third of all of our foreign aid goes to the state of Israel. It is by far the largest recipient of our aid. And we untie strings on that aid that apply to every other recipient of foreign aid. And those strings that we untie are specifically about military, of a military nature. Anybody else has to buy their military goods from the United States. Israel gets money for military expenditures, and they are allowed, because we want to help them develop their own arms industry, they're allowed to spend that money in the development of their own military industry. Now, what is the biggest problem in the Middle East today?
Arms.
Military weaponry. What creates more hatred and frustration with the United States than any other single issue? It is the way you and I, year after year, pour money into aid for Israel. And what's it doing to the body of Christ? Palestinian Christians were 25% of the Palestinian population 100 years ago, if not more recently. Today, it's under 2%. They are almost dead on that cross where they twist. We who so regularly commit ourselves to following Jesus, not just 2,000 years ago, but today, have in the form of, I love what you said this morning in the Bible study about our, you better be careful since you're right here. Calling for a convergence of our Christology and our ecclesiology, so that our body of Christ looks like Jesus. Lutherans are so proud of the centrality of the cross in our theology. I am a Lutheran, even though a bad one, since I work at an Episcopal cathedral. We are not the best. I mean, the cross is central to Lutheran theology. But do we really apply it to modern day Christ's being crucified? And is there a better example of our role of nailing that Christ to the cross than the $10 million a day that you and I send? And when was the last time we ever protested it? in any way, really. Millions of Christians in the United States form a hugely effective lobby for the state of Israel. Jerry Falwell's corporate jet was a direct gift to him of the state of Israel, and guess who paid for that? Because the state of Israel said, you take this jet, and Jerry, no strings attached, we know you're going to fly all over the place and spread the good news about how the state of Israel needs to be supported by the United States. And the movement of Christian Zionism in this country today is far more potent than the statements by Lutherans and Episcopalians or the advocacy of our churches for Palestinian Christians. We got a huge problem. And unlike our divestment action vis-a-vis South Africa, which required, which came on top of divestment from Scandinavian countries and many other European countries, and was like the last nail in the coffin of apartheid and forced the government of South Africa to decide maybe it better start talking to Mandela. So they had these secret meetings with Mandela and then said, oh, the guy's not so bad after all. Maybe we can work with him. And they freed him from prison, and then the cat was out of the bag and a constitutional conference happened and change occurred. Desmond Tutu says, not only do we have all these parallels about the practice of apartheid in Israel today that remind us of how it was practiced in South Africa, we also remember that in South Africa there was a time when it was hard to come by hope that there could be change. When people tell me that, oh, we'll never get the United States to divest from its support for Israel, I remember that being said to me over and over and over again in my lifetime, which I don't think I'm that old. My son feels differently. It can happen. Now, why doesn't it? All week long, this is the punchline, and I am going to move into discussion then. All week long, I have been arguing, first by critiquing charity, that it serves our interests. The reason problems don't get solved by our charitable action is that we only do enough to make ourselves feel better about ourselves, and then we relax and enjoy the way things are and our position with things. Or Biko's words that blacks were going to withdraw their hope from collaborating multiracially with the white liberals in an attack against apartheid because he said the white liberals are only here to make themselves feel better about themselves and then they go back home to their comfortable homes and we continue to live under apartheid. So blacks had to take it into their own hands. Yesterday I talked about the immensely popular Kiva, which is, and who was there and remembers what my single biggest concern about Kiva was? The board of directors. Who said that? Yeah, thank you. It's an all-American organization, and it is so successful at raising money because it's attuned to the realities of the donor. It is very good at understanding how Americans will give money for the idea of microcredit. What the world's largest organization is a global cooperative of churches in which the board of directors is controlled by representatives from the borrowing countries, the need. We do better when we put ourselves into the company of people who are part of the larger body of Christ, and we find our rightful role. And our rightful role as a minority of that body is not to control it. We are not, God has not appointed us the head of the body of Christ. The body of Christ is a source of saving grace to us when we give ourselves into that community, which is largely not American, very hungry, and there is no issue. I believe there is no issue that Americans in general and American Christians in particular are more out of step with the whole community on than policy toward Israel. some of the, there's the ifamericansonlyknew.org, is that the resource on your... I mean, there are tons of information there about how propagandized we are on the issue of Israel. I don't even want to start citing the examples. I do want to say that if we took our baptism seriously, looked for where the crucified Christ today is, and committed ourselves to some global action on this, took our advice about what we should do from the world community, we could change the situation in Israel very fast, and in doing so, we would eliminate the number one reason those who hate the United States hate the United States. So, what should we do? I mean, this ain't going to solve it right here.
It seems that one thing that's happening now is we're setting up these immense and permanent air bases in Iraq. And there's a shift, it feels almost like the post-World War II period, where we're going to come in, as we did in Europe, and set up these more or less permanent bases, which in and of themselves could dilute the need for Israel to be our defensive hub of the Mideast. But it seems like it's an especially bad time for most people to get a grasp on this, because there's a conservative push now to encourage Israel to do preemptive strikes in Iran against the nuclear people. So it just seems like an especially difficult time. And, you know, in the context of everything you're saying, if you go way back in history regarding colonization and all that, from an Islamic perspective, the absolute creation of Israel, like many of the Arab states, is very much a European invention. And so I would think in some ways an Islamic perspective would trump that by saying, well, let's go back another 20 years and say, why are they here in the first place? So
40 years ago, Martin Luther King called the United States the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. Of course, that was 40 years ago. I remember in South Africa, the prevailing thought was, well, with enough military machinery, we can hang on. We can protect ourselves from black anger. And that's exactly the situation at work in Israel today. And we are paying for it because we believe in it, right? That military might will allow us to hang on to our privilege. Yes, sir.
So I'm curious about who the voice is. So I'm thinking about Jimmy Carter and him coming out with a book and how that played out. So in the debate and dialogue about the pros and cons, he seemed to get pretty hammered. And I'm interested in your perspective on how this is, how this perspective that is coming forth and being considered in the body politic and our in the U.S. conversation with itself, and what the chances are, and if he can't get it across and start to make an impact, how does this dialogue unfold?
Well, I think he has made an impact, and I think he has been hammered. But since when is there anything consistent with Christian theology that suggests if you get hammered for speaking the truth, you shouldn't do it? Right? And Carter is no flaming Islamic radical, right? But he does move around the world and talk to more than one side of an issue. And he's figured it out. And so he was willing to name it. Obama, I think, wants to improve U.S. policy toward in the Middle East in general. But as he has said, we have to make him do it. We have to create the political demand for it. And right now, the larger demand that comes from Christians in the United States is for more support to the state of Israel. The Lutherans and Episcopalians and Methodists and Catholics, you know, send a little deputation once in a while and say, please. But do we dare promote divestment of our church at our church assemblies? Do we pass resolutions? The Presbyterians did it. They got hammered and they pulled back. But they took the lead. I give them a lot of credit for that. And which church will be next, and how long will it take? And will there be any Christians left in Palestine when we finally get around to it?
I think there may be an explanation of why there's such a majority that's doing this hammering. I found that postcard that you sent around the most shocking pictorial example of the way peoples or groups dominate others. And I was just envisioning in my own mind a map of the continental United States beginning with 1600, in which the green would be the North American Indian, all the tribes in the group. If you look now at the land they have, it would be specks on this map. So we are, as a people, as an American with this wonderful republic, our history has simply been to simply take over. And so what's happened in Israel is a microcosm of what happened in this continent since we've been here. So
I'd agree, but it's no reason to continue.
I didn't feel very good about being an American when I came in here, and I feel less good about it.
Well, okay, but it is not my, it would not, you know, it might unconsciously serve the status quo for me to facilitate that, but I don't think it would be Christian. God doesn't expect us to be perfect and offers us the grace to realize our mistakes and the opportunity to renew ourselves. Keith.
One of the amazing ironies of this is another player in all this is the United Nations. And in fact, it was the experience of Jews in Europe during the Holocaust, which led to two things that are central. One is the Geneva Conventions, which in fact are expressly against the idea that you move your people into some occupied territory. That's colonialism. And a number of other things. That was bought with blood of all those 6 million Jews. In addition, which is the change, the UN, as a result of this, declared, no longer will the world allow the acquisition of territory by force. The world community is against that. And that's what's happening. So actually, in some ways, not only is it good for Israel's long-term longevity to solve this problem, it is in fact the fruit of their own sacrifice. We just follow that little rule.
Commit ourselves to larger communities than we can control.
It's a really thorny issue, because when I think about just the fact of extracting military armament and money to Israel, there's the fear of 48. And the other part of this,
What's the fear of 48?
Basically, the Israelis were very paranoid, and rightly so, of being exterminated.
They were, well, I urge you to read the book I meant to bring down here and forgot because I was nervous and trying to get it together. One of the foremost Israeli historians is a man named Ilan Pape. And he's just published a book a couple of years ago called The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. An Israeli historian who was very much in the fold and had total access to all the government archives and the military archives. And as he poured through those archives and saw the systematic plan starting in the 30s, culminating in 48, to catalog where the Palestinians were, who were the key leaders in every village, what were the routes of access to that village, and he documents in chapter after chapter after chapter how the ethnic cleansing operation unfolded, and the minutes of the secret meetings that were held, and how they were planning to do this, and they said, and we will just tell the world, we'll make the world believe that we're about to be wiped out. He tackles that issue squarely and argues that consistently for 40 or 50 years, 50 years now, 60 years, the West has been duped by the argument that Israel is vulnerable from its neighbors, when the Israeli government themselves, the key insiders, know that the Arab world had neither the will nor the means to prevent, to really threaten Israel in 48.
Be that as it may, that exists in the United States.
That perception has
yeah. taken hold. So,
right. Okay.
Okay. So given that situation, it would seem to me, if I were an Arabic community, looking at the United States coming in, be they a church, be they anyone else, would be as suspect as Stephen Biko's looking at the white liberals. And so, to me, one of the things that's happening in this world, there almost seems to be a polarization between Islam and the Christian community. And so, I think in my previous thing, I said go small and go person to person. This time, I say we really have to go larger. I mean, there are such there's so much at stake for a huge population of the world right now. And I think that Israel is definitely a target, an easy target for that being played out. I don't think we should lose anyone. But I feel that this will take a lot of thought and action to get this to work right. Because I think it could go either way. It could go nuclear, it could go a lot of things.
I think Israel's greatest fear is that the problem with the situation there at the moment is that it looks like it's a Jewish Muslim they want it to be a Jewish Muslim conflict. That's why the Palestinian Christian population has gone from 1/4 of the Palestinians to only 2% of the Palestinians and declining fast. If it was an Islamic Christian divide, why are the Palestinian Christians so in working in such concert with Palestinian Muslims? I mean, the two, you listen to the Lutheran bishop from Jerusalem, Bishop Yunnan, whose book I think is in the bookstore, along with these other books here, including this one by Anne Hafton, who I learned only 15 minutes before I did this session is coming in tomorrow. Otherwise, I might not have done it. Is she here?
Yeah.
Oh my God. Anne, come in here. I'm so embarrassed. Talk about being ashamed of myself. I mean, this woman knows 20 times what I do. 20 times what I do. And you start teaching staff here for the next week tomorrow. Right. So she'll tell you what the truth is. It's Alex, right?
Ray,
sorry. I'm not the only voice in the room here. What do you think to Ray's concern?
Could I just say one more thing, that in addition to European guilt about the Holocaust, right-wing Christian Zionism, and the American Jewish lobby, there's another factor that we haven't really talked about, and that's oil. And one of the reasons the United States is wanting to keep a strong militarized Israel and protect it is to protect our access to oil. So it's another reason why it was easier for us to disinvest in South Africa, because South Africa had nothing that the United States cared about, essentially, except there were moral issues that we did care about there. We'll never get ourselves to disinvest in Israel while the present geopolitical economic system is in place.
Well, I respectfully disagree with you. I think there was tremendous mineral interests in South Africa and some economic interests, I think. But I think that our support for Israel actually undermines the interests of Jewish people in Israel and undermines our own access to oil. I think we'd have most of the oil. Israel doesn't have any of the oil, and most of the oil is held by people who would feel a lot better about the United States if we would change. Actually, you know, most of it is held by very tiny interests within countries, right? I mean, these are not democracies that we're talking about that we prop up in places. Some of them are, but some of them aren't. Anyway, I'm getting way out of my levels of expertise. Two more questions and then we'll take a break.
Well, I agree with the oil. I definitely think that that's a major motivator. Then as they own the Palestinians, we own Israel. It's sort of a, we can depend on them. We can't depend on the Arabs, and if that, you know, the Gulf is closed off, we can't depend on them.
But how does our support for Israel protect our access to oil?
Military base.
Well, let's negotiate a military base in some other places that would like us to cease our military support for Israel. If we, what do you think about that, Ann?
I think that Israel is America's strategic ally, and that's not going to change. That relationship is in place. I'm not sure. I don't know enough about oil economics to say much about that, but I do know that as our strategic ally, they get a lot more media favor than other players in the region. And also, but they aren't, I don't know this lady's name, but they certainly are not our lackey. They don't, they aren't cooperative, and they don't really help any of our administrations that have asked them, for example, to slow down settlements or the number of things that we politely asked to help them, to help bring climate for peacemaking. They're not interested in cooperating with us that much.
Yeah, we have much more leverage in Saudi Arabia with the leadership there than we do in Israel in terms of being able to get what we want from those in power, I think.
Some would say that's because they're afraid. Or the Israelis aren't.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree. Yes, sir.
Earlier on, you mentioned this website that is excellent in terms of information on this subject. Would you repeat that?
Yeah, it's the one in handwriting at the top of your resource sheet.
Right.
FOSNA.org, Friends of Sabeel North America. .org, or I mean, it's the acronym, the initials. And if you're only going to open one website to look for a little bit more information, I recommend that one. Sabeel is planning. Sabeel does amazing conferences. I've been to two: one in Detroit on ethnic cleansing, and the one on apartheid in Boston. Ilan Pape, that author I mentioned, was in the one in Detroit. Sabeel's next round of conferences will come this winter, and it will include one in Seattle, February 19th and 20th. I think. I'm not sure of the location because I've been out of touch from email for the last 10 days. But
October in Washington, D.C., and another one coming up in Birmingham, Alabama.
Sabeel conferences? And Sabeel takes trips to the Holy Land. If you want to go to the Holy Land with anybody, go with either Ann or Sabeel. And thank you for your attention. I mean, the fact that you're here is a really good sign. The fact that I can speak about this is a reason not to take lightly about our citizenship, but it's also a responsibility. A human rights lawyer in Jerusalem named Jonathan Katab says divestment should be undertaken both for purposes of political leverage and because it's a moral imperative that we stop profiting from other people's crucifixion. So wrestle with that and be glad that you're a Christian who believes in God's saving grace. It isn't up to us to fix it. It is up to us to respond to God's invitation to be saved. And within the whole body of Christ, we have people who can lead us away from our American fears and toward God's saving grace. I really believe that. And so our treasure right now is the money, but could be that crucified Christ still breathing faintly on the cross in Palestine. Go get him.